Listeners to Common Ground, a Prairie podcast, can support conservation efforts in the Great Plains by liking, following, subscribing, and reviewing the podcast. Please like, follow, subscribe, and review to help support our on-the-ground conservation efforts and our education, training, and mentorship programs.
Welcome to Common Ground, a Prairie podcast. This is episode 2, Hope is a Thing with Feathers. Today we travel across North Dakota to ask 2 relatively simple questions. What lessons can we learn from the prairie? And how can birds help us to restore America's grasslands? According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Great Plains have seen over 50 million acres of intact prairie grasslands converted into large-scale industrial farming and other forms of development in the last decade alone. I say this from my home in North Dakota's Red River Valley, a historic tallgrass prairie where less than 1% of the prairie remains. It took over 15,000 years to develop the deep, fertile soils of the region, which was once a glacial lake bed. However, in a little more than a century, we have cultivated America's grasslands to the brink of ecological collapse and lost much of our fertile soil. Throughout the Red River Valley and Prairie Pothole region of North Dakota, several places have lost over 50% of topsoil since 1960. With such dire statistics, we might ask, what reason do we have for hope? In this episode, we visit with 3 incredible women working to preserve and protect grassland habitat in partnership with local farmers and ranchers. Through what we call working lands approaches to conservation, organizations such as Audubon Great Plains, the North American Grouse Partnership, and the North Dakota Meadowlark Initiative are fighting to restore our grasslands and the livelihoods of America's ranchers. Ranchers and conservation organizations are now turning to grassland birds for help, with 2 birds standing out in particular, the Western Meadowlark and the Grouse. The Western Meadowlark is the state bird of North Dakota. Its flute-like songs are as recognizable on the western landscape as the Colt Revolver and John Wayne's wide-brimmed Stetson. It is said that a meadowlark once came to Sitting Bull to sing a prophecy of the Lakota leader's assassination, while countless western books and films have created distinct prairie soundtracks set to the tune of the meadowlark's iconic melodies. Grouse and prairie chickens offer their own unique delights. The whooping sounds of prairie chickens and the ritual displays of grouse dancing on their ancestral lekking grounds have fascinated nearly all who've encountered them. When I drive my Tacoma pickup to our tree shed office, I am often stopped by brave, sharp-tailed grouse who emerge from the tall grass and the ditch line to defend their nesting territory with puffed out chests and regal, flared feathers. The charisma of grouse is undeniable, and yet these kingly birds of the prairie have true grit. In fact, grouse are known to eat grit, or small stones and gravel, in order to aid in their digestion. Since 1970, we have lost 53% of our grassland bird populations here on the prairie. This loss is largely due to the loss of habitat, the encroachment of invasive species, the presence of pesticides, and the cumulative effects of climate change. This episode is not about loss. Instead, it is about hope. What lessons of hope can we learn from the prairie and from the grassland birds who call it home? Literary listeners probably recognize that the title of today's episode derives from 19th century American poet Emily Dickinson, who wrote that, quote, "hope is a thing with feathers." For many of us working in conservation, hope really is a thing with feathers, and the birds of the northern Great Plains are perhaps our best ambassadors of hope. In our first segment, we speak with Jody Provost at her home in the Drift Prairie region of the Cheyenne River Valley. Jody is the Director of Communications for the North American Grouse Partnership, an organization committed to restoring grassland habitat for all 12 species of North American grouse. We visited Jody and her hunting dog, Ava, in late August at Meadowlark Ridge, the apt honorific Jody and her husband have given to the 30-acre prairie restoration surrounding their home. Jody is an avid hunter and horseback rider from North Dakota who spent many years working on conservation efforts in Minnesota. Before you join us on our walking conversation through her restored prairie, let me set the scene. A swarm of bumblebees buzzes in a field of native sunflowers as dust kicks up from the gravel road. It's August. Heat vapors shimmer like western mirages. A woman in a blue baseball cap sharpens her eyes. Behind her, a crooked cottonwood stands a quarter mile off in the distance. A brown-spotted hunting dog zigzags through the thicket of big blue stem and cone flowers, Indian grass, and prairie smoke. A single monarch butterfly floats from milkweed to milkweed while the thrum of insects sing in the stand of over 40 species of grasses and flowers.
Yeah, so what we're looking at is, you know, there's yellow coneflower, or maybe better called gray coneflower, purple prairie clover. The big sunflowers are the helianthus that we mentioned earlier. There's blanket flower, blue flax, partridge pea, plains coreopsis, and then there's a lot more than that too. I know of the 40 species, some of the grasses would be, there's Indian grass, big blue stem, side oats, grandma, that I can see right now. There's a few species of milkweeds too that we wanted in there for the monarchs. We're watching a monarch float by right now. I think also, what's that, maybe a red admiral? And there's, I've been enjoying the bumblebees out here too. I want to get better at identifying my bumblebees.
Yeah.
And we do have a couple beehives in the neighborhood that are dropped off, you know, the apiaries. And so definitely see honeybees out here too.
Yeah. North Dakota is the number one producer of honey, I believe.
I can believe it.
Yeah. And I believe, according to the Meadowlark Initiative, we are losing like a quarter of our bumblebee species, something.
Yeah, I know. That's where when I hear facts like that, it has felt important and useful to do this restoration.
Yes.
There's a big giant cottonwood in front of us, a lone one, and I would like to see that chopped down. It's going to be quite the feat. Very big and wide around, bunch of huge stems at the bottom, very tall, but it's really impacting the purpose of my prairie here out in front of us, so I'd like to take it down if I could somehow. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll get lucky and it'll be hit by lightning.
Yeah, they do have that tendency.
And we've been enjoying, you know, the grassland songbirds out here too. You know, grassland songbirds are also declining the fastest of any suite of bird, as you probably know. And so we have been seeing dickcissels this last spring. There was just a ton of them out here singing away, a bunch of males strategically placed on their little perches. And horned larks have really liked it out here. And of course I hear clay-colored sparrows. And probably many more that I'm not as good as picking up on yet.
That's one thing. I guess it was a few years ago now, I was turned on to the Merlin app, from Cornell University, that you can use to identify bird song, which I think is just really phenomenal, interesting. And for a while, I was so proud of myself that I could start to identify birds by song, so I'd be able to say, oh, that's a gray catbird, or that's a yellow warbler, or there's a mourning dove, you know.
Yeah.
And that feeling of accomplishment and pride lasted maybe about a week until I realized I have no idea what they're saying. You know, and so it's kind of humbling to realize that I can identify the species by song, but how much longer would I have to sit and listen to really kind of understand?
Yeah, I have got friends, you know, that are incredible birders. I myself am just, I would just call myself a modest birder. I'm kind of in the middle of the road. I've got friends, you know, I like to say they can hear one tweedleet and they're like, that's, you know, a Baird sparrow. That's a Henslow sparrow. And I'm just, every time I'm with him, like one of our favorite things to do when we're horseback riding together is bird and plant ID from horseback. Anybody who's not a biologist, we'd probably drive them nuts when they're riding horses. But my girlfriends and I, as we're riding along, and a couple of them are so good at it, I try to just soak it up while I'm with them.
It's a wonderful skill. It's a wonderful hobby. And it's something that, for me, is by nature humbling, in that there's just, the more that I know, the more I'm aware that I don't know, I guess.
Amen. You know? And there's so much that maybe you did know, you forget, and you have to relearn.
Yes.
I know everything out here, like, so I've been seeing some awesome big old toads. I'm like, cool, okay, which toad species is this? I got to figure these out better. I'm excited to hopefully see some prairie skink out here eventually. We've got remnant prairies on the hills here. And I'm hoping some of those critters will be able to move down in here and build populations. Jackrabbits too. I've been so enjoying the jackrabbits out here.
Have you any predator species out here yet? Any coyotes or any?
Oh yes.
You know,
every evening you can hear the coyotes go off a couple different directions. And fox, of course.
And you just pronounce that word correctly, according to all my uncles, coyotes, rather than coyote.
Okay.
Right? And are you familiar with the distinction on the pronunciation on
this?
Okay. So Dan Flores has this wonderful book called Coyote America that I'd recommend to everybody. And in the introduction, he talks about how you can tell a lot about where a person comes from based on how they pronounce the word coyote. Or coyote.
Okay.
And the people that pronounce the word coyote almost always are coming from cities. It's an urban kind of... people who pronounce it coyote are much more likely to come from rural places, places like where we are both from. And I guess I don't know that we can do too much reading into that, but the clipping of the word down to fewer syllables... there's something about that that is a very rural pronunciation of it, I guess. Yeah. There's another prairie sound that you know, immediately kind of puts me on the prairie again, is the sound of coyotes at night, or coyotes at night. And on the farmstead where I live, close to Hoople, there's a fox den on the farmstead, and fox, if you've ever heard, it sounds like a almost like a human being screaming, you know, when it's making its sound. So it's a very alarming sound. But I watched this winter the fox kits be, you know, I watched them like when they were very, very young. They were born in the den and they were coming out. And so I've kind of watched after them this year. And I get nervous every time I hear the coyotes come nearby. And there's been a few nights where we've heard coyotes, and then in the morning, I am glad to hear the fox are still there. But that's one of those kind of ongoing conflicts on the prairie, too, which This is a long way of saying that as much as I look out at a prairie and I see cooperation and I see different kinds of beauty and harmony, there are different long-standing conflicts too,
yeah,
of learning.
Tensions.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, it's part of that ecosystem, ever-changing. Right. You know, and one thing about coyotes that I, you know, read a while ago was there was a study. Oh, there's Ava. There was a study where they found that when there was more coyotes in an area, of course, then there's, if there's less fox because of greater coyotes, the waterfall production of nesting ground birds in general, their success was better because coyotes, I mean, fox tend to take those smaller predators the size of a fox, raccoons, skunks, they tend to take more of the ground nesting birds than coyotes. So having more coyotes actually can be a benefit in that sense.
Sure.
Some of those intricacies that we're learning about, and it probably varies by location maybe, and what the other factors are in that, in the dynamics of that area. But so that, to me, that, that's maybe a reason to not necessarily shoot all the coyotes.
Yeah, no.
Well, and I've been, got a place too.
I've been a huge fan of coyotes for a long time. Mm-hmm. So when I was an undergrad at NDSU, I had recently changed my major from engineering to being an English major, much to the chagrin of my parents and anybody who had a plan for me to make any kind of a living. And so I switched my major, but I was taking this ecology class that was a, you know, large lecture. I think there was like 300 people or something in that ecology class. And they offered the opportunity to apply through the class to go on like a 2-week trip to go and work in Yellowstone on the reintroduction of the Gray Wolf Project. And I wrote basically begged to be part of this group, and I was one of the people selected.
Cool.
And I got to go. So that was sort of my Aldo Leopold moment, was going to Yellowstone and for the first time hearing a wolf howl in the wild.
Yeah.
It is, it still like almost brings tears to my eyes, like thinking about it.
That is the one thing that I do miss about where we lived in Minnesota. We also had, in addition to the critters here, minus some of the grassland birds, we had timber wolves and black bear right in our backyards.
Yes.
And so at night you could hear not only the coyotes, but you could often hear timber wolves very often too. Sometimes they'd come right through our yard and you'd see their tracks or their scat, and the bears.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm enjoying the new things here, like the jackrabbits. I just love jackrabbits.
Yeah.
It's definitely the most colorful right now that it's been probably so far, and it's year plus of existence with the second growing season. It's I'm excited for next year, so we'll give it one more full growing season, I believe, next year. And then probably the fourth year I'm going to start breaking it up into pieces to prescribe burn.
Okay.
And it's, since it's 30 acres, ideally I'd like to break it up into, say, 6 5-acre patches. And each year kind of rotate around burning 2 5-acre patches. So not all the pollinator habitat is burned at one time. Mm. That's what's most recommended, is to just do no more than like a third of the time. And then to vary the burn seasons, if at all possible, depending on what plants I'm trying to encourage or discourage. You know, not always do a spring burn, but sometimes maybe a summer burn or a fall burn, to get that diversity and heterogeneity in it. Because even a prairie needs to have heterogeneity in it. So Audubon, their conservation ranching program, is what we use to help support this project. When we were getting ready to acquire the land, I really asked around, asked Pheasants Forever folks, Audubon folks, our local soil and conservation district folks, kind of poked around everywhere, seeing what resources were available. And the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program was the one that made the most sense for us. So yes, they helped pay for a portion of the seed and support some of the seeding costs, because we had to rent the drill from the Soil Conservation District.
Okay.
And then they pay the first 3 years, they give you a payment to not hay and graze it, so it gets well established. But then after that, you can hay and graze it if you wish. And then in the long term, you're agreeing to at least 10 years leave it as habitat, which is no problem for us because we intend to leave it for habitat perpetually. Maybe even we'll check into an easement someday if that is possible.
So the seedbed prep, what was that? Did you harrowed and all the way down, or did you do more of a no-till or minimal till?
Yeah, so since it had been a soybean field the year before, it was pretty well prepped.
Okay.
So we just seeded with the drill into that soybean stubble.
Okay.
Last spring. And then the neighbor, was actually, he had his packer, and I know with the drill we probably didn't need to pack it, but I wasn't around, and the neighbor asked, and my husband said, yeah. So the neighbor came and just ran his packer over it too.
Yeah.
Which probably was, look, in hindsight, a smart thing to do, because I think we were having a little trouble getting the drill to calibrate right, and I think maybe that little extra seed contact with the soil might have helped. I don't think it hurt.
It's clear that we have a lot of pollinator life, a lot of insect life, a lot of different kinds of, an entomologist would have a fun time out here, I guess.
Yeah, you know? I would hope so. Hopefully more and more over time. I'm hoping these insect population will just build and build and thrive.
Mm-hmm.
So on these remnant prairies around here, on the hillsides, my goal too is to kind of over time collect seed from them and try to bring them out here and introduce them to scratched up spots, you know, maybe where there's pocket gophers, or to get even more diversity out here.
I love what you guys are doing through the partnership and just on your own property. It's really cool get both. And one last shot here of Ava way out in the distance now, moving to the other side and maybe making her way back through the tall sunflowers here.
Since it's after the primary nesting season, she kind of gets to run wild.
Sure.
When the birds are really nesting on the ground, like May, June, July, we try to rein her in better.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because she's got just an amazing nose.
Yeah.
Oh, what a good training ground for a hunting dog. You know? Yeah, wonderful.
She's in heaven.
Next up, we travel to Bismarck to meet up with Heather Husband, coordinator of the North Dakota Meadowlark Initiative. Listen to our conversation to hear Heather describe the lessons she's learned about diversity, beauty, and toughness from the prairie. And stick around to hear how the Western Meadowlark is helping her to bring local ranchers and conservation organizations together to support a working lands approach to grasslands conservation.
We are losing grasslands in North Dakota. We only have about 25% that are left. And connected to that is the loss of vital grassland habitat and the wildlife associated with it, but also a decline in ranching operations. And both are part of North Dakota's great heritage that we have. For the grasslands, since 1970, we've lost 53% of our grassland bird population. That means approximately 720 million fewer birds on the landscape. So that's fewer bugs eaten and less available food in the food chain and for other wildlife as well. Approximately 1 in 4 bumblebee species are at risk of becoming threatened or endangered. That's just one of the many pollinators that are out there that we know. So along with that, we have that decline in pollinators, which are needed for our flower gardens and crop production and all the rest. But also, we have fewer ranches on the landscape, grass-fed livestock operations. And ranchers are our grassland stewards. What many people may not understand is that native prairies need to be managed. They evolved with bison and fire, and without cattle on the landscape, it's easier for invasive species to take over. Plants are less robust, resilient, and diverse in times of weather extremes, whether that's flood or drought. So the loss of livestock producers on the landscape also means harder times for the rural communities and businesses that are connected to them. Hardware stores, gas stations, grocery stores, banks, schools, the list goes on and on. In 2002, 40% of farms produced cattle, according to the USDA. By 2017, that number was down to 33%. The decline has continued, and it's expected to be around 30% when the data comes out for this year. So, but the thing about why native prairies are so important to us is they don't only provide wildlife habitat and food for livestock, but they also provide vital services to all of us, whether it's filtering water and improving water quality, or sequestering carbon dioxide and methane, which are two important compounds when we talk about problems with weather extremes. Native grasslands actually sequester, or store, more carbon than forests do. Some of our native grass roots can reach between 12 and 15 feet in depth, and so they're able to pull carbon and methane deep into the soil, where the microbes that keep the soils healthy use it for food. So it's all an important chain right there. So that's a few of the reasons that are conservation issues that we're concerned about in North Dakota, and this is what the Metal Ark Initiative was born out of.
I guess I'm curious, why the Western Metal Ark, or what role does the Metal Ark play in this initiative, and how did that come about?
Right. So as I mentioned, grassland birds are in serious decline, and the Western Metal Ark is a grassland bird, and it's also seeing that serious decline. Lost about 50% of its population since 1970, and right now actually it's on track to lose another 50% of its population in the next 45 years. So it's seeing a serious decline. It's also our state bird. So it's a bird that people recognize both by sight and by song. A lot of people will come in and talk to me and go, yeah, you know, I hear that bird all the time, or I haven't heard that bird in a while. So it's something that people can identify with, and you know, when we want people to value something, we want them to be able to identify with it. We figured that Western Metal Ark served kind of all those purposes and would be a really great ambassador for the program as a whole.
When I was a professor of literature and creative writing at a university in Connecticut, I would often play the song of the Western Metal Ark for my students, and that lilting, lifting melody and how beautiful it is. But the school where I taught at, the mascot was the Blue Jay. And so I'd play the song of the Blue Jay.
Not quite as beautiful.
Not as beautiful. It sounds like a mechanical car horn, you know.
Attention-grabbing it is.
And so my kind of guidance to students was, it's okay if you don't at first on the page sound like a Western Meadowlark. Just be a communicative Blue Jay and we'll work from there.
You know? Absolutely.
But the Meadowlark has long been a favorite of mine. So what personally, I guess, motivates you to do this kind of work, and how did you become involved in this kind of work?
So I've always been a how and why kind of person. I want to know how things are connected. I love the concept of food webs and ecosystems and how things work together. I spent many summers and weekends with my grandmother on her childhood farm, and we did wildlife walks and bird watching, and she taught me the value of connectedness. Both being connected to nature itself and how seen and unseen, living things don't live in isolation. There's connections. There's a million tendrils that are out there that you don't always expect, and to look for those kind of connections. This initiative was kind of set up with five elements in their vision for how they wanted to work. And I'll tell you what they are, because it relates to that whole connectedness part that I like. To revitalize, reconnect, and sustain existing working grasslands and ranches. So it's not only the habitat, it's the people who are out there managing for us and keeping it working, keeping it part of, I mean, it's their livelihood. We need to make sure that this continues to happen for them so that they continue to provide habitat for the birds. To reinvent and implement a statewide grassland reconstruction program. I mentioned there's tons of programs out there that have grassland pieces to them. And the idea is we can't work in our silos. We need to work together. North Dakota is a huge state. There's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of land out there that we can work together in. So reinventing how we deliver these programs and kind of making that connectedness together. Offsetting impacts to grassland habitat function and value as development advances. Nothing is static. It does not stay. It's not meant to stay. There's always going to be changes in your life, on landscape, all the rest of that. It's the idea of, okay, accepting that change is part of life. How do you manage that to keep the things that are important of value to you, to keep operations, to keep livelihoods, to do all that? So how do you, you know, if you're going to have development in one area, how do you offset that and balance it out? And so that was another component of it. Promoting sustainable and resilient grasslands for vibrant communities and human well-being. So again, connecting that, you know, while we focus a lot on the habitat and the ranchers, it goes beyond that. It goes into communities. It goes into everyone in the state of North Dakota and how it affects their well-being as a whole. Like I said, it might be, you know, the ranchers are concerned about plant diversity, But all of us are concerned about carbon sequestration and soil health and water quality. That affects far and wide. So making that connection again to sustainable type programs that help everyone. And then the last little bit is to advance grassland ecosystem recovery through science and education. You could throw all the money you want to in the world at something. If people don't value it and don't see the value in it, it's not going to affect a change.
And I love that you're bringing up the importance of storytelling and outreach. Robin Wall Kimmerer, in her book, Braiding Sweetgrass, argues that the first step in ecological restoration is a restorying of our relationships to land. And one of the things that also struck me in your answer is the influence of your grandmother. And, you know, I too am doing this work largely, I think, because of my grandma, who was a Scots-Irish Okie, who was displaced during the Dust Bowl to the fruit plantations of California, where her dad became a Baptist tent preacher and delivered these apocalyptic Jeremiads to the fruit plantation workers. And, you know, so my grandmother became kind of a migratory bird in a way. Mm-hmm. And she's the person, it was embarrassingly late in life that I learned that the person who taught me most about what it means to be a Norwegian wasn't one. My grandma was not a Norwegian, uh-huh. right? And so that idea of change, element that I also heard in your answer there is just the sheer magnitude, the size of North Dakota. It's the least visited state in the lower 48. My home county is 1,294 square miles, which is Walsh County, 80 square miles larger than the state of Rhode Island. And there's 8.2 of us at the last census per square mile, right? And so that makes that connection, neighbor, community, really vital. And so part of what we're after in this podcast and in our broader outreach efforts is to be able to tell multi-generational stories, which I think it's how I learned conservation work and to care about land is through grandparents and uncles and aunts and parents. But then also to extend who our neighbors are to multi-species storytelling and to learn from other species. And so I heard a lot of that in your answer there.
Especially the ranching communities are very heavy into the multi-generational. And that's some of their struggles sometimes is how to make that transition from one generation to the next. But it's so tied to family and history and everything else that, I mean, their love for the grasslands is as deep as any conservationist that comes in. And so just keying off of that. We all love the same thing. And that's the great thing, I think, about grasslands is the same point or spot can serve a function for a variety of people just by being healthy and being what it is. And so just being able to have that common point of interest and work off of it is a great thing, too.
Yeah. What advice would you have for individuals who are interested in getting involved in this work? Here I'm thinking about young people in particular. Okay. What do you imagine young people's role can be in conservation efforts? But then also thinking about businesses, ranchers, landowners, producers, farmers, community members. How do you see people playing a role in getting involved in this kind of effort?
Okay, so my advice for young people, I'll start with those that are maybe in the educational phase of things. So they're learning about stuff. Maybe they don't really know what they want to do as a job when they grow up. Don't put up boundaries when you learn, because you will never know what direction your job is going to take. Mine has been all over the place to get me to where I am today. And if I had put up boundaries and said, well, I'm only going to do wildlife something, I never would have had all the experiences that helped create the skills that I have for this job. Meet people, talk to people. The more that you can talk to somebody and hear their story, the less us versus them it is. And the less us versus them, the more you have a point where you can do collaboration, you can do conversation, you can work out solutions to problems if you don't have that big wall of us versus them. So definitely that. Like I said, the looking at the jobs, if you think you're kind of interested in this area, don't pigeonhole yourself. There's everything from, I mean, there's the traditional wildlife jobs like the Fish and Wildlife Service, the State Game and Fish Office. You could work for a conservation, an NGO conservation entity that maybe focuses on a specific species more like pheasants or ducks or something like that, but also has the ability to reach out to people to get people interested in conservation or hunting or bird watching or all those kind of things. Writers. Having writing skills, having communication skills, I would make that a number one priority for any wildlife major. So many come out and they just have the science skills and they don't have the communication ones. And those are, to me, the most important ones, because you can't affect habitat improvement or protection or any of that if it's just you and the piece of land. There's no way it can happen. And I think it is really important to value the knowledge, the experience of those that are older than you generationally. That is extremely important because they've been there, done that, and they can help you with so much if you just listen. But on the other side of that too, don't assume that you have to do everything the way that your grandmother or grandfather did. The new technologies that are out there are amazing and developing every time. So if you can find a way to blend some of that old knowledge with the new ideas that are coming out, especially in grassland management, you're going to have a more resilient farm, a more profitable farm, and having that diversity is just going to, it's going to help the resource as a whole. So that's really important.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I just wanted to come back to is how excited we are in our district, and I think I'm seeing some of this in other areas throughout the state, where we have 19, 20-year-old college students coming back to work for us in our district, and also retired farmer. You know, we have a retired farmer who's planting our grass, and we have young college students who grew up on farms who are coming back and working with us. And the retired farmer is readily adopting the role of being a teacher, a mentor. And so we have our young people who work with us are being trained to be the watershed coordinator. They're being trained to be the grassland management folks. So really giving real responsibility to our staff beyond just being tree planters or just kind of doing seasonal work, trying to give them real responsibility, real opportunity. And then because I am a writer, I do also try to mentor them in the making of the podcast, the making of our documentary, and in grant writing, which is really crucial to kind of open up avenues of funding. You know, going back to the size and scope of North Dakota and the number of people, there's more work here to be done in conservation than there are people to do it. There's more going on in one cubic yard of living soil than I'll ever understand in one lifetime. I mean, there's just the more that I learn about grasslands, the more it's this subject that is just an endless archive of ideas and materials that we could be learning. So if you're somebody who loves to learn and commit yourself to learning, I think that's, you know, there's a lot of opportunity in this field. You know?
I think too that the other great thing too is most people that I've met that are involved in agriculture, ranching especially, but crop production as well, it is not their occupation, it is their vocation. And being able to talk transfers some of that passion that they have for what they're doing. And, you know, honestly, just if you want to have a good life, you need to have passion in your life. And I think so much of that mentorship type thing is just great at being able to transfer that passion to people and get them excited about what's around them.
What are the biggest challenges currently facing the Meadowlark Initiative today?
In agriculture, there's a little bit of an imbalance when it comes to crop agriculture versus rangeland agriculture. Crop agriculture, and it's not to demonize it, crop agriculture is great. It has all sorts of great support programs. It has, you know, all the USDA programs that are out there, insurance, other, there's just so many support for crop agriculture. And the folks that are in that know about it. They know where it is. They know what people to ask if they are curious about it. It's pretty well established. On the grassland livestock side, there's stuff there. It's not as big. It's not as much. And it's not as advertised. And so just getting the word out of what's available, about what can be done for assistance, especially as, you know, we're going to have more and more of these weather extremes, you know, to help them out, create a diverse operation so that it can be sustainable. That's one of the biggest challenges. My favorite spot is to be out on some spot of prairie grassland in the morning, and it just, you know, the birds, the breeze, the everything. It just, it makes my soul sing. So a spot that I thought I'd never be, I came here in the late 90s, and it was permanent. It stuck.
I've bounced around and moved all over, but I remember reading that during the Civil War, on some of the soldiers' death certificates, the cause of death was listed as homesickness. And I know we probably don't recognize that as a real form of fatality, mm-hmm. but man, I feel like I came close to dying of homesickness when I was out there. What's the most important lesson you've learned from the prairie?
My most important lesson from the prairie, I would say establish deep roots, diversity inspires beauty, and have quiet, persistent patience. That's what the prairie could do. I mean, it can sit out there through 10 years of drought and still provide cover and food. Yeah. It can, you know, it's tough. It takes a while. You have to have patience for it to get there. But once you do, it's tough.
It really is.
It hangs in there really hard, most North Dakotans.
Yeah.
Pretty tough.
Finally, we travel to Fargo to talk with Amanda Boer near Wildflower Grove, a pollinator and grassland restoration project in Oak Grove Park, sponsored by Audubon. Amanda is an Ohio native who has fallen in love with the prairie through her work as communications manager for Audubon Great Plains. Keep listening to learn about Audubon's film, Wings Over Water, the beautiful documentary focused on the migrations of mallards, yellow warblers, and sandhill cranes, produced in partnership with the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture. Listen closely to see if you can hear the alien songs of the cicadas singing in the sugar maples, and stay tuned to hear how Amanda's young son inspires her to work to preserve grassland habitats.
So we are located where?
We are at Oak Grove Park, which is in Fargo, North Dakota, and we are located at one of our urban woods and prairie parks too, where we've done some restoration projects along the river with Fargo Park.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Audubon Great Plains and how it addresses conservation issues in North Dakota?
Yes, Audubon Great Plains is part of the National Audubon Society, and our mission is to protect birds in the places they need today and tomorrow. Where did that come from? Are we in the range?
We are filming this, shooting this in a frolfing, I believe, is what we call that, frisbee golf range.
Golfers around,
so
I guess.
We're kind of extreme podcasters here today.
I love it.
We had a frisbee just about take us out there,
here
but we you were saying that yes. Audubon Great Plains works in the community and
so part of this location is one of our things with conservation is that we really want to engage our communities to connect with our local parks. So at Oak Grove Park, where we are today, it's part of our Urban Woods and Prairie Initiative, where we do a lot of restoration along the river to restore habitat for wildlife and mostly for birds. And then also encouraging folks to get outside and exploring nature too. So by playing games like frisbee golf or going hiking and birding on the trails, they have an opportunity to engage in the community, engage in nature, and indirectly they're kind of engaging in conservation. We also have a working lands program. Our working lands programs across North Dakota includes conservation forage program, where we work with landowners and producers to restore marginal cropland back to prairie habitat. And then we also do prairie management toolbox, where similarly we work with ranchers and producers who want to improve their habitat on their property and they need additional funding or support for seeding and fence infrastructure. We work with them to restore their land so that they can improve conservation in our state.
So you were talking about the work that you guys do with ranchers and landowners for conservation purposes, providing habitat for grassland birds and songbirds. I was actually just with Jody Provost at her house. She's with the North American Grouse Partnership, and they did a 30-acre restoration at her place that I got to see that
awesome.
I think was through the Audubon.
Yes, yep.
And so they rented a grass seeder from their local SCD, their local mm-hmm. soil conservation district, kind of a multi-layered partnership to make that happen. I guess this feeds into my next question is, how would you describe a day in the life of your work? Like, do you work directly with farms, ranches, ranchers, or are you more doing like outreach, education? What kind of
work? I think I have the best job, to be honest, but I don't get to work directly, but I do know Jody. So what I do is communications, which is a lot of behind the scenes computer work, to be honest. So social media, websites, print promotion, and digital promotions like emails. But one of the best things about what I get to do is sit in on planning meetings with our partners and our landowners, and just provide support for various workshops too. We host prescribed fire workshops, or we do stuff with our local communities to engage families and people to get outside in nature. So I get to connect with them too. So through those different avenues, I get to be away from my desk, get outside in nature and explore our different parks or land that we've helped restore. So for me, every day kind of varies. I'm in the office a lot, but in the summer months especially and in the springtime, I get to be outside, go to the workshops, help support the events that are happening, and then connect with our landowners and producers that way.
You had mentioned that you'd done some work in this very park, right?
Yes.
What are some of the things that you guys did in this park?
So along the river in the trails, kind of, you know, this is a podcast, they're not going to see where I'm pointing, and I can't even tell you what direction
that's okay. Ira Glass, who does This American Life, says that radio is a visual medium.
Okay.
So we have to describe it out loud for the people. Yeah. So
I couldn't tell you exactly the acreage, but this Oak Grove Park connects to Wildflower Grove over there, kind of by the river, which ends up being a place that has a nice bike trail. And along the bike trail, we have restored some of the grass back to native prairie so that it's not just Kentucky bluegrass or any monoculture grass that isn't really providing a lot of diverse habitat for our insects and our birds. We've provided a lot more different prairie and natural plants along the river and along the bike path. But what's so important about the work that we've done here is the root system can help prevent flooding. As you probably know, a lot of flooding happens when the soil is just saturated with water. So native prairie plants will have 15 feet underground of roots that are gonna absorb the water and help hold it in. So when the thaw happens in the spring, we're likely to not have as big of a flood because these native plants are doing their job and holding the water in and storing it instead of just letting it seep to the top of the soil.
So the more that I learn about grass, I mean, the more blown away I am by how amazing it is. I mean, all the things that it does for us, all the ways that it really is, can be a buffer for things like flooding, is habitat, food.
Yep.
I mean, all of these things, and in a natural grassland, it's so vital to everything that, you know, the entire ecosystem really depends on grass.
It really does, and it's, I mean, so, you know, we're an organization that cares about birds and protecting them, but by protecting the earth and the habitat, we are creating this ecosystem that then provides food and habitat and shelter and nesting materials for birds. So it's kind of a wildlife collaboration that they all get to benefit from. And then people benefit too because they don't have flooding as common. So back when you talked about in the 90s, the flooding that happened in Grand Forks, that likely would not have happened if we had left the ground be and didn't change, you know, the prairie and turn it into parking lots, grass lawns for people to enjoy. If we left it a little bit more to native prairie and didn't sod bust everything, then flooding probably wouldn't have happened in the 90s.
That's such a fascinating and important point, I think, for thinking about the way that going to prairie, seeding prairie, can really be a benefit to humans as well. That it's not, we don't have to think of it as at odds with, you know, what we're trying to do here. So I guess what motivates you to do this kind of work, and how did you become involved in conservation efforts in North Dakota and throughout the Great Plains?
Such a good question. First, I would say I am motivated because, like many people, that I'm noticing as a trend in my role as a communications person is for future generations. I have a 4.5-year-old, almost 5-year-old, and I want him to be able to get outside and enjoy nature and connect with it in a way that's not superficial. I want him to be able to just enjoy and see the beauty in places with native prairie. I used to think that native prairie was kind of not that beautiful, or it didn't really draw me in because I didn't know enough about it. And now I'm just mesmerized by the beauty and the diversity of the colors of grasses and the ecosystem it provides, the different insects, the bugs and insects and birds that migrate there to call it home. I find that to be absolutely amazing and phenomenal. And so I want my son to learn those things too and appreciate them and also witness them. I think right now so many bugs and insects are disappearing. You know, monarch butterflies, we do a lot to try to help support pollinator habitats too, which then in the end goal helps support birds because pollinators and insects kind of work together, which provides food for our birds. Making sure that nature is just supported and protected makes me really happy because I want my son to be able to enjoy them. And then second of all, I personally just love being outside and enjoying the work that we do is really rewarding. Instead of just being at a desk all day long working in different sectors, I appreciate the nonprofit world and wearing different hats. I don't have a conservation background either. I have a communications background, and the conservation part was very much learned for me, and I'm learning every single day, but I'm always amazed every day by the things I learned, the things that my team can do. We have experts that meet with landowners and producers and do amazing restoration on large acreage across the state to help restore the habitat. And to me, that is just absolutely exciting and phenomenal and can help save the globe, the earth, like everything comes together. And then ultimately, I've also always had a love and care for birds. My mom used to get the Audubon magazine when I was a child. I grew up in Ohio, and so I remember cardinals being everywhere. I don't see them as much in North Dakota, but I still love a sighting of a red cardinal, especially in the winter, because it stands out so much. So I just appreciate everything that conservation gives to our community and to families and for the future.
There's so much I want to pick up on there. Yeah. Well, I did my graduate school work at Ohio State. So I spent six years
awesome.
In Columbus, and I actually just saw a buckeye was
oh,
one of
yes.
the trees
I
over
saw that the other day.
And I'm
yes.
like, oh my goodness.
Buckeye
yeah,
trees, you don't see
so
them
cool.
up here, right?
Yeah.
yeah.
And so that's really cool that
awesome.
We have that connection. What part of Ohio?
I grew up in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then
yeah.
I lived in Cincinnati after
oh,
college, but
cool.
I went to Bowling Green State
oh,
University.
Yeah, yeah. Okay,
so,
cool,
yeah.
very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, well, so that's really fun. And then the beginning of your response there, you talked a lot about beauty, about mm-hmm. trying to recognize the prairie as beautiful. And I grew up in rural North Dakota, so originally in Grand Forks, but by the age of 9, I was already living in Park River, surrounded by these big monoculture fields. And for me, I continue to see a monoculture sunflower field is beautiful.
Yeah.
I continue to see a monoculture wheat field as beautiful,
mm-hmm.
even though my ecological training is starting to make me question some of that.
Yeah.
That and so I don't know if there's so much a question here, but one thing that might be vital as we move forward in conservation work and communication to bring those things together is to teach us how to see something like a prairie as beautiful.
Yes.
How do you, and the way that I've been thinking of this, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, is I'm trying to think of what comes first, affection or attention. Do I need to have affection for something and then I start paying closer attention to it? Or do I pay closer attention to it and that develops the affection and maybe it's a little bit of both? I don't know.
That's a really good question. I've never thought of it that way, but I do think you're right. I think it's a little bit of both. But for me, it's probably the attention first because I have been exposed to it a lot more in this role. And I've had really wonderful opportunities to be walked around prairies with landowners who are just so passionate about restoring their land and what they do, and then also with my team who will stop and see something that I didn't see, whether it be an insect, a flower, a grass, and they'll pull it and then tell you so much about it. So that has really blown me away and has been really enjoyable. So I think the attention I've given it has created for me a lot more affection and appreciation And hopefully there's ways to scale that down so it's a little bit more approachable for everybody to learn about the prairie.
It's one of the things that I've been doing a lot with my crew this summer. So sadly, they're now back in school. I mean, it's good for them to go back to school, yeah. but they spent most
summer
of the summer with us.
Summer people are so great. Yeah. Yep. We have some too.
And so I had two high school interns and three college-age students working for us this summer. And because I'm a former professor of literature, I would start our days often with a little poetry or a short essay. And so one of the things that they read was a piece by Robin Wall Kimmerer that originally appeared in Gathering Moss. So she was become quite famous for her work braiding sweetgrass.
I was just thinking of braiding sweetgrass. Yeah. I was like, have you read it?
Yeah. And so I've read Braiding Sweetgrass. I love that book. In fact, a book club locally invited me to give a talk on it recently.
Oh, cool.
And so it's been something that we've been trying to kind of promote in our community. Yep. But in Gathering Moss, her earlier work, she has this chapter titled Learning to See. And it's about learning to pay attention to moss and what happens to your ability to kind of notice things when you're thinking on that granular level and really noticing. And we paired that with Aldo Leopold's essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, that originally appeared in the Sand County Almanac. And what I guess what I like about thinking about the prairie is it's a little bit harder to get people to fall in love with the prairie in some ways, as opposed to like the ocean or a mountain.
The Amazon forest.
The Amazon rainforest.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have an answer for the because. What is it about the prairie that makes it sometimes difficult? I mean, I find it so easy to love now and so obvious to love now, but I think
I've only thought about that in comparison to the Amazon rainforest because the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest is so widely known and people care so much about that. And if we can get them to care that much about the Great Plains and the amount of like tall grass prairie, there's only 1% left in the United States. And that is a huge problem, but that's not as, I'm going to say that's not as sexy as the Amazon rainforest being deforested, because I think it's a scale thing. Honestly, the Amazon rainforest is so massive in like, I don't know how to say this, like physically tall and wide and broad and protected, or they're trying to protect it. But our Great Plains just seems a lot easier to just get rid of because it does seem a lot smaller. So the insects and species that we have living in our, you know, prairie are a lot smaller and we can do a lot more research with that. But I think the Amazon still has this mystery and magical unknown element to it that the Great Plains just doesn't, or it does, it's just not sold that way.
Yeah.
But that's the only answer I have. I'm otherwise not sure. I feel like it's something that we take for granted. We drive by, you know, on the highway and you see the plains forever as the eye can see, and you just don't see a whole lot when you're looking at it at that speed and scale.
To me, what you're saying resonates so much for me, because often when you're on the Great Plains, we call it flyover country.
I mean, we are a flyover state.
We fly, you know, this is the least visited state in the country, right? Yes. Here. We're here. We're in it. And so to be in such a place that, you know, we have really phenomenal writers that are from here. Louise Erdrich is, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning indigenous writer. My friend Taylor Brorby has just published his memoir. So we have people that are writers and are trying to story this place and write about grass and grasslands. I think about Layli Long Soldier, her poetry collection Whereas is also featuring grass and grasslands, how important they are, particularly to indigenous people on the plains. And yet the speed, that driving 75, 80 miles an hour, it's really hard to notice how important grass is when the pollinating insects just end up on your windshield.
Right. You know? Exactly.
And when it's just a nuisance, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
But when you stop and are able to slow down, which I don't know, it's hard to sell slow down in the culture of rapid speed, right? But when the prairie demands that you do things like slow down. And when you slow down and notice the prairie, it reveals entire universe is. I mean, there's so much going on. There's, I've said this before, but there's more going on in a cubic yard of prairie than I'll ever understand in 10 lifetimes.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Same.
Yeah. So I know that there's this Wings Over Water documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's covering migration of three birds that migrate in the spring. So we have the sandhill cranes, the yellow warbler, and the mallard duck. There's obviously so many more birds that migrate, but this documentary focuses on the amazing journey that these birds go on from their wintering grounds to their breeding grounds. I actually haven't seen it yet, but I rewatched the trailer today and it looks so beautiful. The footage is all over the United States. They have drone footage of the yellow warbler flying in the sky, following it in such high definition video. So it's gonna be truly amazing to see. And it's a good reminder of what's at stake here. They travel from Canada, or from Mexico to Canada, and they stop along the way at so many different places across the country. And so there are no state boundaries for birds. Their habitat needs to be available everywhere. So the work that we do in North Dakota is important, but we need to just broadly across the United States make sure we protect these habitats for birds. They need food, they need water, they need nesting grounds, they need insects, you know, everything that they need to survive on these amazing journeys that they do. It's so incredible. They travel thousands of miles every year.
Well, thank you very much, Amanda, for being on with us today. I've learned so much from your experience working with the Audubon Great Plains, and it's been a joy to have you and to talk with you. And I guess go Buckeyes.
Yes, go Buckeyes. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Common Ground, a Prairie Podcast. Perhaps the most important lesson I learned from my conversations with Jody, Heather, and Amanda is that conservation requires collaboration. A working lands approach calls on us to find common ground with a wide range of folks, including ranchers, conservation organizations, and everyday citizens. It calls on us to work with the land and for the land. And it calls on us to listen to all the other species who call the prairie home. In our next episode, titled Thinking Like a Prairie, we talk with Dr. Kurt Miney, Senior Fellow of the Aldo Leopold Foundation and the Center for Humans and Nature. Tune in to hear our conversation about the legacy of Aldo Leopold as we celebrate the 75th anniversary of a Sand County Almanac, the book that inspired me and countless others to work in conservation. Listen to the episode to learn the backstory behind Leopold's famous essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, and hear Dr. Miney speculate about how we might learn to think like a prairie. And tune in to hear us pay tribute to the Kiowa writer N. Scott Momaday and the conservationist Estella Leopold, both of whom passed away this year. We look forward to sharing more stories with you from the prairie. Until next time, this is Josh Anderson signing off for Common Ground, a Prairie Podcast.
I guess one of my favorite sayings, we've got it on our website, is by Aldo Leopold about grouse. Aldo Leopold is the father of wildlife ecology, as many people know. But he, in one of his quotes from a Sand County Almanac, he said, "The grouse represents only a millionth of either the mass or energy of an acre. Yet subtract the grouse, and the whole thing is dead."
Listeners to Common Ground, a Prairie Podcast, can support conservation efforts in the Great Plains by liking, following, subscribing, and reviewing the podcast. Please like, follow, subscribe, and review to help support our on-the-ground conservation efforts and our education, training, and mentorship programs.